Thank you for joining us for Life and Taxes with tax attorney Andrew Foster of Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. Call in now with your tax questions at 800-818-2255 or locally at 247-7282 or 353-4674.
Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Ben.
What do you got for us today?
Well, Ben, you know how we stress the importance of filing a tax return on the show.
Right, right.
Just saying, look, whatever you do, just make sure that you file. All right. So today we're going to do
even if you file poorly.
That's right.
Just file.
We're going to do a couple cases today, and I'm going to give you even more incentive to make that tax filing, because we're going to show what a difference it does in fact make, especially in cases where the IRS asserts additional income against your return.
All right, let's have our first case.
Before we get to the first case, Ben, let's talk a little bit about how we get there.
All right.
How we get to the tax court. Mm-hmm. All right. And the way that we get there is what's called a notice of deficiency.
Okay.
All right. And this is what I'll call your ticket to the tax court.
Your ticket. Okay.
Your ticket to the tax court. Yeah. You don't really want to get that ticket.
You're not standing in line for it.
If you do get it, then what it does is it gives you 90 days to petition to file with the tax court to say, I want my case heard.
Huh.
If you fail to petition the tax court within that 90 days, you forever lose that right. And we've been through some cases before, you might recall, about how people get the notice and was it the date of the notice? Is it this? Is it that? What if the wrong date's put on there? We've gone through some procedural issues with the notice of deficiency. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, when you get that document, it's going to be sent certified mail, and that is your antennas need to go up. And please give me a call, because we need to discuss what your options are, because you have a limited time to make a decision. Now, how do you end up with that notice of deficiency? There's really two ways that you end up with a notice of deficiency. Number one is that you go through an audit process. Mm-hmm. So the IRS sends you a letter and says that we believe, we want to see some information regarding your return. And then the auditor makes a determination that either, number one, we don't believe some of your deductions or your credits that you've taken. Or number two, we believe that you have additional forms of income and we want to assess that against you.
Okay.
And the formal way that it's made
is
a notice of deficiency.
Okay, you go through the audit first and then they make that.
That's right. That's number one. That's one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The second possibility is you don't file your return.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the IRS uses the information returns, those W-2s, those 1099s, and they file a return for you.
Mm-hmm.
And they do what's called a substitute for return. And then they give you notice they're making the substitute for return for you, but eventually they have to assess the tax. And
right.
How do they do that? A notice of deficiency. And they say, you're on notice now. This tax has been levied against you. And immediately after those 90 days elapse, if you fail to petition the tax court, they will start the collection process against you.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how we end up with this notice of deficiency.
Okay. Now, again, that failure to file, they're probably not going to get to it like April 16th.
That's right.
Yeah. It's going to be a while before they actually determine that you haven't filed, and then they file for you.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
But is there a typical time period of that?
It can be any time within 6 months to, even years, years afterwards, because there is no statute of limitations regarding when they can file for you. Yeah. So just that, they can wait, and the whole time they're waiting, guess what's happening?
Yeah,
penalties
ching-ching.
And interest. Ching-ching. That's exactly right. Yeah. They're just tallying up against you.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the important things about these notice of deficiencies, Ben, is that when they deny a deduction or a credit against you, it's your burden to prove those. We've talked about substantiation and making sure that you have documentation to back up anything that you put on the return.
Right.
But what's interesting is when they assert income against you, they say, hey, look, we got this 1099 or this W-2 with your social security number on it, and we're asserting this against you. The courts have taken a position that potentially the IRS has to do more than just get that 1099 or W-2. They need some other type of substantiation. The burden's on them to prove that that income is yours.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting take, that's a little differentiation when we have these assertion of income cases. And that's what we're going to go through today,
okay,
which is the two cases that I wanted to compare and contrast for you guys to show you, again, the importance of filing a tax return and what it means to actually get that tax filing made. Mm-hmm. And with that, we'll start with our first case today, which is Mr. Portillo. So Portillo versus Commissioner. And Mr. Portillo was a painting contractor,
mm-hmm,
okay? And he kept a general ledger of his gross receipts, and he actually filed his return timely.
Mm-hmm.
And then he included $11,000 from a client named Navarro.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Navarro actually sent a 1099 to the IRS and said, no, I paid Mr. Portillo $35,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? What happens? We got a return saying 11. We got a 1099 saying 35. Mm-hmm. You better believe it. He's going to get audited.
Right.
And so he does. So Mr. Portillo gets audited. And during the audit process.
Well, then does he have to send also to Mr. Portillo that 1099? That copy,
yes,
of the 1099?
Okay. Yeah.
So he sent one to the IRS and one to him.
Sent one to the IRS, one to him.
Supposedly.
And then during the audit process, the revenue agent reaches out to, mm-hmm, you know, Mr. Portillo, obviously, because he's involved in the audit, and says, you know, what's going on? You know, why is there a difference between the 1099 and your return? He says, that's what he paid me. He paid me $11,000. I don't know why in the world he sent that document to you that says $35,000, you know, mm-hmm, but, you know, you need to take that up with him, basically.
Uh-huh.
And the agent does. He takes it up with Mr. Navarro and says, okay, show me some information, show me some proof that you paid Mr. Portillo $35,000. And Mr. Navarro came up with checks totaling $14,000.
Uh-huh.
So about $3,000 more than the $11,000 that Mr. Portillo reported on his return. Mr. Navarro said, the rest of it, cash. I paid him in cash.
Okay?
And so the IRS agent goes, good enough for me.
Oh, good enough.
Good enough for me.
Okay.
I'm asserting the full $35,000 against you, Mr. Portillo. So you've got an increased burden in tax. And so what does Mr. Portillo do? He gets his notice of deficiency. He goes to the tax court. He says, tax court. He says, I'm saying 11. He said 35. He can only prove 14.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't understand. How am I supposed to prove the negative? How am I supposed to prove that I didn't receive
cash,
the cash that he's saying I did? This is unfair. And the tax court says, nah, we don't care, Mr. Portillo. We're the full 35 is going against you.
Oh, wow.
We're going to believe the 1099 and its sacredness.
Hmm.
And so he says, well, forget that. We're going to the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fifth Circuit said just that, Ben, which was they believed that it was, you know, arbitrary and erroneous that the IRS could take the position without further investigation
evidence.
That, you know, Navarro was actually telling the truth and Portillo's lying just because, mm-hmm, there's this 1099, mm-hmm, that's hanging out there. And so the Fifth Circuit actually reverses this and says, no, there's got to be something more than just the belief that the 1099 is correct,
mm-hmm,
and that the taxpayer is lying.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the Portillo case taught us. All right. And so Mr. Portillo won.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously I think the 14,000 would be the number that probably when it got sent back down,
right,
would be the one that they would,
right,
hit on, because that's the one that is substantiated.
Unless I wasn't paid for those services.
So
you didn't pay for something else.
Exactly. But I mean, I believe that's the way that it would shape up and form.
Yeah.
But the key here is.
Now is Navarro in trouble?
The key here is that, and the distinction is that this 1099 doesn't have this sacredness, that there has to be something more to it, mm-hmm, than just that. And that should give some taxpayers some solace when they get these erroneous 1099s. And I'm telling them, look, you know, try to work it out with a person, but in the event you can't, file what you think is correct and send in a notice and letter and say, you know, like, this is why this 1099 is incorrect. And then you get to this, you know, obviously you'll get audited, and then you get to the point here where they're going,
right,
to reach out to both parties and see who they think is correct.
Hmm.
Flash forward, and after the Portillo decision, Mr. Parker,
mm-hmm,
was involved, and he said, okay, look, Mr. Portillo, this 1099 is not so sacred after all. So Mr. Parker doesn't file a return at all whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes through the process, and they, of course, file substitute for return for him based upon the 1099s and W-2s that the IRS had. Mr. Parker just doesn't respond whatsoever. He gets his notice of deficiency, and then I guess it's certified mail. He must have thought, oh man, this is real now. This is real business. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go ahead and petition the tax court. And he petitions the tax court, and he says, well, wait a second here. You know, you did no investigation. You filed the substitute for return for me, but you did no investigation as to whether the 1099s and W-2s that you filed on my substitute for return are correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's wrong, because Portillo case says that you have to go investigate this matter.
Right, right.
All right? And so you've got a burden here that you have to do, and you didn't perform the burden, and therefore your substitute for return is incorrect.
Okay, I'm gonna bet the tax court did not agree with that.
Did not agree, and actually it goes up.
Because he didn't file.
Exactly, and this one actually goes up to the Fifth Circuit as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exactly right, Ben, because Mr. Parker failed to file. The Fifth Circuit basically says there's no duty to investigate because you didn't give them an alternative.
They're right.
You
right.
didn't give them something else to look at. When you sign your tax return, you sign under the penalties of perjury.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying this is correct. And then if a 1099 is different than what you put on that return, then mm-hmm. there needs to be investigation as to whose numbers are actually correct
right.
to make a proper assessment.
But you didn't sign a return.
But when you don't sign a return and you do not file, you do not get the protections of Portillo. You don't get the protections of the Portillo case. It is not the IRS's burden to go and prove that the 1099s and W-2s are correct. It's your burden to file your daggone return. So you can give them an alternative.
I want to see that in writing, daggone.
So I, when I read this, this blog post,
mm-hmm.
Tax Prof blog, I'd recommend any of our listeners to go check it out. It's actually pretty entertaining. It shows the difference between ones who do not file and ones who do file and the protections that you get
All
by
right.
filing.
If you want to find out more, you want to call on the folks at Harvell & Collins and Andrew Foster in particular, go email afoster@harvellandcollins.com or call for an appointment at 726-9050 there at 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City.